Okay, Pipeheads, just before we get into the last tycoon, I did want to provide you with an update on the lawsuit. Sorry, what? No, I'm on the podcast. I'm just recording the podcast right now. Check my messages. Okay. Oh, the printout. Sorry, Pipeheads, my assistant has just alerted me to look down to the left of me in our inbox. And they have actually printed out a message for me here. And they're insisting, they're signaling to me, you look ridiculous. No, you look like a seagull. Yeah. Well, because you're flapping your. Anyway, they've asked me to just read this message before I actually make this episode. So let me just see what we've got here on this piece of paper here. God, this is a small font. Don't mention lawsuit. Don't talk about sorcerer episode. Don't read this message out live on air. Okay. I think we get the message, don't we, Pipeheads? Not supposed to be talking about this. Okay. Just forget this part of the episode. You're actually here for our review of The Last Tycoon, the 1974 Elia Kazan episode there on Movie Pipe. So let's just, I'll hit stop now and my lunch is done. I'll hit stop and then I'll record the next bit, and that's what you'll be listening to after this. Now, Robert De Niro had three movies released in 1976. One of them was The Last Tycoon. One of them was a movie called 1900 or 1900. I think they're referring to the time period in history there, not the time based on the 24-hour clock. And I've not heard of this one, Taxi Driver. So I'd have to check that out. We haven't seen that, have we? Can't find any reference to that on the internet. So it might be a little bit of a bootleg movie there he shot, because he's just up and coming, isn't he? Mr. De Niro hasn't quite made a name for himself yet. Anyway, The Last Tycoon, 1976 there. Robert De Niro, he is brilliant in this movie. And it's also weird because looking back on the early De Niros, and certainly if you haven't seen some of De Niro's early work, you're basically bringing all the baggage from his work, subsequent work. So, 1976, what's that? 40 odd years ago, 45, 47 years ago. So all of the movies that he's made since The Last Tycoon in 1976, all of those characters, all of the De Niroisms that we've come to love, or not, most of us love it. And even those weird movies that he's made in recent years, where it's obviously a cash grab, but power to him. He's one of the greatest living actors America has ever produced. So I think he's entitled to set himself up with five, six, seven vacation homes. I mean, people say you don't need another home. Mr. De Niro is proving you wrong. Anyway, back to The Last Tycoon here. And, on Movie Pipe, when we watch these movies, they've often been on our lists for years. We have a watch list that we keep. Gigi and Will, we do share that through a series of faxes. So we fax it over. You can fit about 10 movies per sheet, and there's over 600 movies on our list. So that's quite a lot of faxes that we've sent back and forth trying to figure out the strategy for what we should watch next. And there is a big committee that also acts as a intermediary between that decision-making process. So all in all, we probably have about 37 people helping us figure out what movie we should watch next. And through that process, we are only told. So I've just found a cockroach in this, my third vacation home. Through that process, we're only told literally minutes before we hit play. So we're brought into a special screening room. I'm in the United States of America, and Will, he's over in some little island in Europe called England, and we are brought into a special screening room, which if I was to blindfold myself, put myself on a transatlantic flight and relocate myself to the English screening room, as I'm walking into that room, as I'm taking off the blindfold, having travelled for probably about 12 hours, I would still think I'm in the United States, because my screening room in Florida is exactly the same as Will's screening room in London. Why do we do that? Because if we do ever travel, which we haven't done yet because of this Heineken virus, we won't be able to tell where we are. And that's all part of the job. It's all about familiarity of our surroundings. We don't want to feel unsettled when we watch a movie that's been on our watch list for literally decades. So just wanted to give you a little bit of a behind the scenes glimpse into what it takes to produce this seemingly off-the-cuff, random, unprofessional podcast. This is all a tightly choreographed act, Pipeheads. You don't get this level of production with the famous movie podcast, do you? It all sounds like they have a studio and professional recording equipment. They have a jingle, there's ads, they have famous guests, there's usually more than one host. They have a team of researchers. They have good, strong opinions that's backed up by evidence. They cross-reference their sources. Even when they get things wrong, they often go back and will have an editor's note, don't they? And we just don't do any of that. That's not what Movie Pipe's about. That's not why we have eight people listening right now. Two of which are ourselves, because we always listen back, don't we? When artists say, oh, I don't watch, who is it famously said they don't watch their own movies? Oh, every actor. That's right. Because they're humble introverts, aren't they? Yeah. They're not at all megalomaniac narcissists who just want to see their face projected 100 foot across on an IMAX screen. They're not those people. That's not why they're in show business. They're in show business not to watch themselves on screen. That's their entire venture. That's why they became actors, because they're not interested in seeing themselves on film or on digital. So they go to extreme lengths. And some of them have played the genetic lottery there, haven't they, with their looks. Some of them have got lucky. Others banded into that character, method acting bracket, because they're not particularly hot to look at. But then when you do see them in the real world, they're highly manicured, aren't they? And that even though they look weird, it's because their face has appeared on that big screen, or the small screen if you've only got a TV, or you're watching on your fucking phone, as Ridley Scott would say. good old Ridders there. You know, what was my point? The Last Tycoon is about movies. So this has now got me thinking about movies, and it's all very meta, isn't it? And Robert De Niro there, a young Robert De Niro coming out of the back of two other movies, one of which we haven't seen, and the other one is quite good, I hear. He's still finding his feet as the De Niro we now know today. He didn't have 45 years of acting under his belt. So at the time, we didn't bring all that baggage, did we, to those roles when we watched him? He was just an interesting up-and-coming actor. He'd obviously appeared in The Godfather Part 2 there, and really would go on to have an incredible 70s and 80s, and then sort of lost his way a little bit, didn't he, in a recent couple of decades, for the odd exception of The Goodfellas, The Heats. I like Ronin. I liked him in Ronin, but it was a cash grab, let's be fair. Anyway, De Niro deserving of his own podcast, and I'm sure there's a very professional Robert De Niro podcast out there available now. You can go and find that via the Google internet machine. But Bobby De Niro here, very young, almost looks sick, and that's why he's perfect for this role, because he plays a young movie executive, and this story is based on an unfinished novel by some bloke who he has quite an unusual name. There's a couple of F's in it. Anyway, this is an unfinished novel. I think it's based on The Great Gatsby or something like that. And it's an unfinished novel, and it's also an unfinished movie, because I think they got to like the end, you know, the last page of the book, and they realised he hasn't finished it. So this movie just sort of ends abruptly, because they ran out of pages to film. There wasn't any more words that the actors could say. I think probably the cameraman or camera person sort of probably looked up, didn't he, from behind his camera, his heart rate, or their heart rate probably increased a little bit. Maybe there was some beads of sweat across their forehead as they nervously glanced towards the director and just desperate to signal, we've run out of words to say here. We don't know how to. What should we do? Should we turn the camera off? Should we all go home and have a nice lunch? Because I think they finished before lunch back in those days. This was shot in the 70s and they didn't work beyond 1 p.m. did they? Because they're all getting drunk and smoking opium. Anyway, The Last Tycoon here is, it's a finished movie in so much as you can finish it. It does have an end. But during the production, they actually ran out of words to film. So it's quite a strange experience, because it does just kind of end with Robert De Niro sort of walking into the darkness of a movie studio. But, dear Pipeheads, I was told, I did read online on a forum, an internet chat room, that this is all part of the story. And it's not just simply they didn't have enough words to film, so they couldn't end the movie. This is actually part of the movie. This is now the clever part. So I didn't realise that when I was watching it, that this was intentional, but it was actually part of the decision-making process. So this is what we learn on this podcast, is movies have other meanings. It's not just simply they're stood in rooms with cameras and they're reading words. No, there's actually other things going on, Pipeheads. There's symbolism, there's metaphors, there's analogies, there's all these things that go unwritten, subtext. So anyway, The Last Tycoon, I think, is a great subtextual movie. But when you watch it today, it's very clunky. That's not to say I didn't enjoy it. I did enjoy it. But there's a clunkiness to the signalling of those symbols, the way they deal with the metaphor of the movie, I think is very clunky. Now, back then, 45 years ago, it was probably innovative, but obviously this is based on a book. I've not read the book because it's unfinished. I've refused to watch or read unfinished works. I don't care who wrote it. I need those books written. I need the last 25 pages with words on. Otherwise, it's just I might as well use it for fire kindling when I go camping. Anyway, this, you know, the symbology contained within this movie. There's a, you know, Robert De Niro's character. He's a movie executive. He's very driven, very ambitious. He's a workaholic. He has intimate control over the productions, the movies that he's making. And that is derailed by a young lady that he glances floating into frame on a giant golden, looks like something like a Buddha's head that's come from one of the movie sets on the back lot of this studio that he works for. So again, lots of symbology there. My interpretation was they were sirens, you know, like the sirens calling the sailors to crash and wreck their ships so they could loot the treasures on board that ship. But they weren't looting a ship, were they, Pipeheads? No. They were looting Mr. De Niro's heart, and that was my interpretation with these beautiful ladies as they drifted in on this golden Buddha head, giant Buddha head, about 15, 20 foot tall. It drifted along, and De Niro was absolutely starstruck by these sirens. And there was a siren in the background. Again, here's the symbology and the metaphors, isn't it, in the movie-making decision process. They're like, let's throw in a siren there because it really makes it obvious that these beautiful creatures on the golden head there aren't just people. They're a device to draw the viewer in. There's a subtext, isn't there, Pipeheads? This movie is riddled with it, and I don't want to ruin it because there's actually a lot of nice little clues as to how the ending does happen. I probably ruined it actually a little bit. If you were paying attention to the drivel before, I did ruin the ending. Don't rewind, just try and forget what I said. Won't be difficult. Anyway, so this movie is kind of split in two. The first part is building De Niro's character, but through that, the movie is communicating, is signalling, is messaging certain things about his, not only his character, but the world that he's part of. There's this brilliant scene early on where it cuts to, you know, he's walking through the back lot and there's all this stuff going on in the background. And there's a group of young people, I think tourists, who've come to Hollywood to look behind the scenes of a movie studio. And you've got the old guy there, the tour guide, talking about the different types of stages and all the effects that they're able to build and create in Hollywood there. And he's like, oh, and you know what, young people, impressionable young people, let me tell you about earthquakes. You know how they create earthquakes in movies? They either shake the camera, they move the set, or the actors sort of shuffle around as if they're being, there's some earth turbulence underneath them, or a combination of all three. And that's, dear young people, that's how we make the movies in Hollywood, isn't it? And as he talks about the earthquake, a big flag goes up, doesn't it? In the, because we're professional movie critics, we're like, yeah, that's going in the notebook, because that is called foreshadowing. That foreshadows something that happens in the movie for real, but it's a movie, so it's not a real earthquake. So we know that that guy, the old guy, the tour guide, who told us how earthquakes work in movies, we now see an earthquake in the movie we're watching, but we know it's not real, don't we? Because we're actually watching a movie. But that's the beauty of this movie. It's very aware of itself, even if it is a little bit clunky. But I quite liked it because there's an enjoyment in understanding the language of film, isn't there, Pipeheads? And when you get to our level as professional movie critics, and you're paid to do this for a living, this comes naturally to us. Understanding the language of film, the language of cinema, is natural to us. So this is why we do this podcast. It's to help idiots like you get a little bit more intelligent, rather than just saying, oh yeah, I like that rock movie. Anyway, The Last Tycoon, outside of earthquakes and Robert De Niro's performance, which is very studied, almost wooden, but I think that's deliberate. And then as the movie progresses, there's a tonal shift in De Niro, and he brings this extra layer. So in this movie, he is going through a range, kind of an arc, of emotions, and he becomes something that's sort of been under the surface the entire movie. You realise is this obsession and this, I wouldn't say paranoia, but a certain amount of control freakishness that he has begins to slip away, and he doesn't quite get his own way, and he begins to indulge in a vice, and that vice is alcohol, and he gets very drunk and he embarrasses himself in front of some important people, and ultimately that's his kind of downfall, his emotional downfall. However, the person that he embarrasses himself in front of is Jack Nicholson. He's in this movie. I didn't realise he's in this movie. And he's kind of turns up, and he's, you know, I didn't realize Jack Nicholson was alive in the 30s where this movie is set. I mean, Robert De Niro's acting one of those characters. He's not really alive in the 1930s, was he? This movie was made in the 70s, but Jack Nicholson, I didn't realize he was alive at that age in the 30s. So there's some magic movie stuff going on here. Anyway, Jack Nicholson turns up, and he looks a bit like the guy from Chinatown, that private detective he plays. He's kind of got the same look, the same face, the same eyes, nose, mouth, teeth, ears, hair, neck, cheek, eyelashes, eyebrows, elbows, knee. You get the idea. Anyway, so Jack Nicholson's in this movie, and he's pretending to be a union member, like a guy who is in charge of the writers' union in Hollywood. And I tell you what, he gives a very convincing performance. It's a little bit distracting because it is Jack. You realise it is Jack Nicholson, and I think he's undercover in this movie as a character. So, but he gets. I think he gets away with it because he looks a bit younger. So he's not the kind of, you know, as good as it gets about Schmidt age, is he? So he's a bit younger. So I think the younger generation watching this movie for the first time, and the majority of our listeners are under the age of 80. So they probably won't recognise it as Jack Nicholson. They'll just think, oh, there's an actor there playing his part in this movie opposite Robert De Niro for a period of time, does a decent job, and then, you know, that's that. But this, you know, to the eagle-eyed movie critics, they fumbled this one because it's clearly Jack Nicholson in this movie. And it was fun to watch because once you realise that, you're in on the joke, aren't you? You're in on the joke that they try to smuggle one of the most famous actors into this movie, thinking we wouldn't notice it. I mean, enough time has passed, hasn't it, Pipeheads, since this movie's been made. I think they thought maybe we'll forget about it in the future. Audiences will just forget that Jack Nicholson's in this movie. But he's there, isn't he? And very peculiar. Anyway, and I think that put Robert De Niro off, and that's why they couldn't finish this movie properly. Also, they had the words problem, the pages. There weren't enough pages left. There weren't any words to film. But this movie ends in a bit of a sulk. So Robert De Niro sort of wanders off in a bit of a huff. And, you know, to the insiders, we all know what that means, don't we? Yeah, well, the ending of that movie is ambiguous. Why is it ambiguous? Because the book that it's based on, the story that it's based on, didn't end. And because it didn't end, it leaves it open to interpretation. And that's what this movie does. It allows us, dear Pipeheads, to indulge our imagination. And it asks the audience to question what happened to Robert De Niro. He just walked into this dark room. Is he okay? Was there someone else there with a torch? Did he have a cigarette? I don't know. Did he ever come out? Or was it some sort of interdimensional thing? We won't know. We'll never know. Unless you meet Robert De Niro. And it's probably not him. It's probably a variant or a clone of Robert De Niro. Because he did get lost in this black hole at the end of this movie. And side note, I think if you were in a cinema in 1976 watching a young Robert De Niro there walk into the void of a movie studio, you could certainly interpret that as some sort of symbol for Hollywood during the 30s and especially the 70s as it moved into the 80s, which is the decade of excess, isn't it? So I think there's some sort of sea change trying to be communicated there, and also the void of success, the void of fame, and the darkness of Hollywood. Ultimately, there's an underbelly to Tinseltown that a lot of these movies try and communicate in a very subtle way, but it's all there on the surface, isn't it, dear Pipeheads? Sorry, I had some soda at lunch and it's repeating on me. But I think if you were sat in a cinema in 1976 watching a young De Niro there walk into the void of the movie studio, and the way it's framed, there's a slow dolly zoom in as he walks into that, so you know he's walking into a movie studio, but then the entire screen is taken over by that void, that darkness. And I think Dear Pipeheads, it would actually look like Robert De Niro was in your cinema walking into the screen. And I think that's the ultimate message, isn't it? That we're all lost in the world of cinema. Even Robert De Niro, one of our generation's greatest screen actors, gets lost in cinema and he can't find his way out. I do hope he exited into the parking lot. Perhaps there was a waiting chauffeur or limousine to take him to his hotel room. I think he's okay because he did then appear in another movie. So he did get out. But we are left wondering, aren't we? Like, what happened to Robert De Niro there? Jack Nicholson, he wasn't in that scene, but I think he got out. He was edited out of that. So he's fine. And some of the other actors are fine. Oh, by the way, I can't mention his name because of the lawsuit on the Eddie Coyle thing. But there is a rather large bear-like gentleman in this movie. And it was nice to see him again. An old friend there from Eddie Coyle and what's that other one that we've watched and we did an episode on and I can't remember what it was. The Yakuza, that's right, yeah. So a slightly younger gentleman who I can't name is also in this movie and he plays Robert De Niro's sort of boss. And there's a very, very, very ambiguous scene at the end where De Niro's love interest in this movie, you know, they're basically destined to be together. And then the last minute, she sends him a telegram, a bit like a fax, that she's now got engaged to her previous flame, who was out of town conveniently for the beginning of this movie. He's now back and he enters a room. We never see his face, but he looks like the bear man. So you're left wondering again, did she sleep with the bear man? And is that just another knife in Robert De Niro's back? Because it's all about competition and the ruthlessness of fame. That was The Last Tycoon, 1976. A strange, weird movie that I absolutely loved. It's about movies. If you love movies, you will love The Last Tycoon. There's a lot to analyse. There's a lot to think about. It's ambiguous. It's open to interpretation. It has a young De Niro, for goodness sake, figuring out who to be as an actor. There's some fantastic scenes where he's trying to educate a scriptwriter, an English scriptwriter, played by Donald Pleasance. And it's absolutely the through line of the movie because that scene is recalled again towards the end of the movie, but you're now seeing it from a different point of view. So it's no longer you're observing the room, you are now in the room. De Niro effectively breaks that fourth wall that he actually walks through at the end, doesn't he, dear Pipeheads? Because we love talking about the fourth wall, and he tells us he's in the movies, and that's why I love The Last Tycoon, 1976, a Leah Kazan movie. Do seek it out. It's on the Criterion Channel. That's not a commercial for the Criterion Channel, but they do have some decent movies if you can read the subtitles. That's it for now, dear Pipeheads. Movie Pipe. Just a quick prologue here at the end. Sorry, epilogue. I always get those two mixed up. Just a quick prologue here. After the episode I recorded there for The Last Tycoon, the 1976 Eliza Kazan movie, I didn't talk about the house. And I didn't talk about the incomplete house that Robert De Niro's character often ends up at during the movie. And I think that's one of the most clunky visual metaphors in this movie of clunky metaphors. But it's very effective. What can I say? And he spends a lot of time in this house. And it's like, okay, it's an incomplete house. Like the story you're watching is incomplete. Because it's incomplete, because the story it's based on was never completed. So there's like these layers attached to this house. And also, his life is incomplete. He's yet to fulfill it. And he's designing and he's controlling every element. But it's also what I realised, dear Pipeheads. What I just realised is that house, because it's not yet fully constructed, it's almost like a the wooden frame of a house. That's like a movie set, isn't it? He takes his love into his movie set where he can control the world and enact the story that he wants to tell and edit and cast and produce and reshoot those things. That's genius. That's filmmaking. Just wanted to add that in there as a prologue at the end of this because I did forget about it and I didn't want to leave that episode incomplete. You see what I did there? Movie pipe.